This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. On Wednesday, the National Hockey League and the Players Association announced that the two sides have reached, quote, an agreement in principle on a new collective bargaining agreement, which will end the 10-month-old lockout and clear the way for a 2005-2006 season. If ratified, the new agreement will institute a salary cap, but will it adequately protect the owners from their own inclination to pay extravagantly for players they really, really want? Scott Burnside, who has covered the NHL lockout for ESPN, thinks that it might.
I'd hate to use the word idiot-proof because, these are NHL owners we're talking about. So I think as much as possible, this new system does prevent that kind of wild spending from maverick owners that distorts the entire market system.
Joining me now to comment on winners and losers in the NHL's front offices, on the ice and in the seats, is Helene Elliott, who writes about the game for the LA Times. Helene, it's been too long. Welcome back to Only a Game.
What's the matter? You don't call, you don't write. I was feeling so neglected.
We're going to have to call you about other sports if this ever happens again. You're right.
You know, I was sitting there going, I have no friends anymore. Okay.
Well, let's get right to the business of the day. A quick glance at the speculative key terms of the new agreement suggests that Commissioner Gary Bettman and the owners not only won this war, but that the players lost in spectacular fashion. Is that your take as well?
Yeah, there's really no other way to interpret it. I mean, players can say, well, we got free agency at a younger age, and we got the agreement to play in the Olympics, which they very much wanted. But just looking at every other term of this thing, and the owners clearly won this.
The union conceded a 24% salary rollback, the salary cap they swore at one point that they would never accept, a tie-in to league revenue, a nullification of all 2004-2005 contracts. The list goes on and on. Why were Bob Goodenow and his team willing to surrender so utterly in July of 2005 what they would not surrender in July of 2004?
Well, I think they very, very drastically underestimated the unity of the owners. And I think they finally came to the conclusion that the owners were not going to cave. Goodenow had told players all along, hey, these guys are going to cave. They're going to get weak. Just wait. Just keep waiting. We'll get a better deal because they'll get so desperate. They'll have to fill their arenas and they'll just go crazy. But Bettman kept all those guys in line, all those teams. We're very united in this thing, unlike the lockout 10 years ago when people started getting nervous. So they made a deal that ended up being very punitive for the owners. I mean, at first glance, it looked like, wow, the owners had won that one too. But then they found all these loopholes, particularly the bonuses for rookies, and you could drive a Zamboni through all the loopholes that they found in that thing.
Commissioner Gary Bettman had been criticized in the past for his inability to get the union to bend to the owner's will and even for presiding over what some characterized as a dying league. With his rout of the union, has he earned commissioner for life status?
Like some Republican in South America, yeah. you know, he's always going to be a focus of criticism. There are a lot of people who don't like him simply because he's not a quote-unquote hockey guy, you know. But the league didn't need somebody who could tell you the lineup of the 1943 Montreal Canadiens. They needed a businessman. They needed a guy who was going to be a tough negotiator. And that's what he was. I mean, this is what they needed. They needed these very drastic changes to the system that they had, and Bettman got them.
Whether fans will return to the game in the short and long terms will depend on a variety of factors, many of which the league is debating as we speak. What changes should the league make in the rules or in the way games are broadcast in order to make hockey more appealing?
Well, I think all they really had to do, and all they really have to do now, is just call the rule book. Just call the hooking, call the holding, call the obstruction. You know, they are going to make some rule changes. I think you can pretty much count on seeing a shootout to resolve ties. There will probably be some other little things, tag up offsides and some other things. But those, to me, are gimmicks. And I suspect that the only people who are going to notice those are people who are hockey fans already. Hmm. They're not going to win any new fans because of any of these rule changes. You know, the shootouts are exciting, but if you see them every night over the course of the season, I think they kind of lose their novelty and they lose their drama. You know, at the Olympics, seeing a shootout settle the gold medal, that's fabulous. I mean, you can't get more dramatic than that. But, you know, a Thursday night game between San Jose and Phoenix, I'm not sure that's really quite so exciting.
You reported two Fridays ago that the sides were close to an agreement, which the league immediately refuted, even though, as it turns out, of course, you were right. Was this just representative of the way this weird lockout and coverage of it have gone?
It was just the most joyless, bizarre, ridiculous experience I've been through in my years in this business. It was just, the progress was so slow, and I understand, and I'm sure any lawyer that you may know would tell you that when you're negotiating a deal like this, it's going to be very, very slow. But to take 10 months out of people's lives and to get people out of the habit of going to hockey games, to lose sponsors, to lose ESPN, they really had better make this worth it. They really can't mess up this time. They're not going to get another chance. And whether this chance is going to be enough for them to win back people and to exist, it is certainly up for debate, but they can't mess this one up.
Because of a special contract buyout clause in the new collective bargaining agreement and the trimming of team rosters last year in anticipation of a protracted lockout, there will be a free agent frenzy this summer, the likes of which the National Hockey League has never seen. Will this be a good thing for the league, or at least for some of the teams?
I think it's going to be fun. I think you're going to see a lot of teams that have big payrolls. They're going to have to do a lot of scrambling to get under the salary cap figure. The thing that you're going to see that you didn't see before is that some of the smaller market teams are going to end up with big-name players. Because if everybody's operating under the same economic rules, you're not going to see 12 superstars go to Detroit or Colorado or the New York Rangers. You're going to see the Rangers say, okay, we signed these many guys. We're at the cap. Sorry, we can't sign anymore. So other people may end up in Columbus or Phoenix or smaller markets that in theory should really help the competitiveness.
This new agreement will run 6 years. What's your best guess as to what will happen when the two sides sit down to discuss the next collective bargaining agreement?
Oh, please, can't we take this one crisis at a time? We're not finished with this crisis yet, please.
Helene Elliott is the collective bargaining chronicler for the LA Times and is at long last again only a game's NHL nabob. Thank you, Helene.
Thank you.
Richard McKenzie, who's been the caddy manager at St. Andrews for almost 13 years, couldn't have been happier that Jack Nicklaus was competing in the British Open at the fabled club in Scotland this week, unless Nicklaus had been playing just a little better. At 65, competing in what he has said will be his final tournament, Nicklaus did not make the 36-hole cut, meaning that he will not be out on the course today and tomorrow. That doesn't diminish Mr. McKenzie's regard for Mr. Nicklaus.
The whole history of Jack Nicklaus, what he's done for golf, what he's done for European, but in particular Scottish golf, and even more so what he's done for St. Andrews, we can't ever pay back. You can never repay what this guy's done for us.
Of his 18 wins in major tournaments, three of Nicklaus's triumphs have come at the British Open, two of those at St. Andrews. When Richard McKenzie and I spoke earlier this week, Jack Nicklaus was practicing his putting just a few yards from McKenzie's office. As we were still a day short of Nicklaus's opening round 75, I could ask Richard McKenzie to fantasize about what it would be like if Nicklaus won the British Open again.
Oh, well, hey, listen, I hope he does. I've got 100 quid on him. I'm in cloud nine, as you can tell, because he's one of my heroes of the game. And I think we all feel that way about him, and he'll be a sad loss to the game because there aren't too many people, real people, like Jack Nicklaus around.
Richard McKenzie is joined in that sentiment by, among others, the Royal Bank of Scotland. The bank, which occasionally prints commemorative currency, has issued a £5 note with the likeness of Jack Nicklaus on it. As Andrew Wilson, a spokesperson for the Royal Bank of Scotland, explained, that is quite a distinction.
Well, Jack is in quite remarkable company in terms of the notes of the Royal Bank of Scotland. Only two other people who have been alive have been featured on the notes, and that's the Queen Mother, now late and much missed, and also Her Majesty the Queen herself from her Golden Jubilee in 2002. So this is a very significant honour, and it's not one that's given lightly, but we think it's more than deserved by a man who has been at the top of his game globally all of his life and has been a great ambassador for the sport and an ambassador for sport generally.
Mr. Wilson explained that the Royal Bank of Scotland has printed 2 million of the Nicholas £5 notes. He can't say how many of them have found their way into the hands of greengrocers or turf accountants, but he does know that the notes have proven to be popular collectibles at St. Andrews.
As a patron of the Open Championship, we have a branch on the golf course this week, and we had 600, 700 people queued out there very early in the morning this morning to make sure they got their hands in one of the first editions.
So they're trading in their currency from all over the world for Jack Nicklaus £5 notes?
They are indeed, and I'm not sure they'll be spending it behind the bars in St. Andrews tonight. I think they're going to be taking a lot of them home, and they'd be very welcome to do so.
The celebration of Jack Nicklaus and his accomplishments in Scotland and elsewhere has not been completely unanimous. In a column published before the British Open began, London Times writer Matthew Side complained that Nicklaus shouldn't have been exempt from having to qualify for the British Open. When we spoke earlier this week, Mr. Side accused Jack Nicklaus of being so enamored of the experience of playing before a sentimental crowd at St. Andrews that he'd probably come back and do it again. I asked him if indulging in that sort of sentiment really did anybody any harm. From the press room at St. Andrews, he defended his position.
Well, I can tell you in one sentence, when Nicklaus comes here at the age of 65 and misses the cut, he's denying a younger, poorer, better player the chance to be here, and somebody who might have qualified on merit. Nicklaus gets an exemption. Other people have to either be ranked in the top 50 of the world, or they have to battle through the qualification competition. Nicklaus just turns up, and he could, if he wanted to, turn up till he's 150.
That complaint notwithstanding, Matthew Side acknowledged that no matter how Jack Nicklaus played in this Open, he wouldn't tarnish his remarkable reputation at St. Andrews, in the United Kingdom, and everywhere else where golf is played.
No, I don't think so. I think his legacy is intact, robust, and little that he does from here on in could damage that. 18 majors and is an extraordinary achievement. And I think, as with Muhammad Ali going on too long against Spinks, against Holmes and against Berbick, we still recognize what he did in the 60s and early to mid-70s distinguishes him as the greatest boxer, Nicklaus the greatest golfer. And I think that legacy is intact.
Yesterday at St. Andrews, Jack Nicklaus shot a 72, leaving him a not quite good enough 3-over par for the first two rounds of the British Open.
Where did you get those pants? Where did you get those pants? Where did you get those pants?
It's 19 minutes past. I'm Bill Littlefield, ahead on Only a Game, Stock Car Racing, Safest Men. But first, yesterday saw the completion of Stage 13 of the Tour de France. The relatively flat, fast stage was won by Robbie McEwen. On Wednesday, Italian rider Dario Frigo was charged with helping and assisting in the use of doping products, contraband, and importing when authorities found the endurance-boosting drug EPO in his wife's car. Lance Armstrong, winner of the past six editions of the Tour, holds a 38-second lead over Michael Rasmussen of Denmark as the race enters the Pyrenees today. They are trailed by Christophe Moreau and Ivan Basso. Spain's Alejandro Valverde, who had been fifth overall, dropped out of the race with a knee injury halfway through yesterday's stage. At tomorrow's New England 300 in Loudon, Kurt Busch, winner of both of last year's NASCAR events at New Hampshire Motor Speedway, will try to extend his track winning streak to three. Jimmy Johnson will attempt to widen his lead over Greg Biffle in the chase for the Cup, and Tony Stewart will endeavor to stay safe in his quest to win three events in four races. Stewart's attempt to go 3-for-3 last week was hampered when he crashed during Friday's practice at Chicagoland for the second year in a row. For Stewart, Carl Edwards, Jeff Gordon, Mark Martin, Michael Waltrip, and the other drivers who have crashed this year, it's probably little consolation that every discernible bump and scratch has been measured, recorded, and analyzed in NASCAR's ongoing attempt to build a safer race car. The scientists who take and analyze those various measurements are the subject of an article in this week's Sporting News, written by none other than Matt Crossman, who joins me now on the line. Matt, welcome to Only a Game.
Well, thanks. How are you doing?
Very well. Thank you. In your article for this week's Sporting News, you explain the inner workings of a group you call CSI NASCAR, and I gather they are not the heroes of the latest CBS crime drama.
No, they don't check the car's DNA or anything like that. In this case, what the CSI stands for is Crash Safety Inspectors. And I added the crash. Their official title is Safety Inspectors.
I wonder why. That's their official title.
Yeah, the safety they're inspecting is crashes, so I added the crash.
Now, why did NASCAR decide that the sport needed its own crack team of investigators?
Well, that's a great question. And it actually goes way back in the sport's history. They've had some form of safety inspector basically since NASCAR was founded over 50 years ago. But in 2001, when Dale Earnhardt died in the Daytona 500, that really was sort of a thunderbolt to the sport in many issues, and safety was probably the biggest one. The structure of this team and the way it's formulated really came out of that.
One particular phrase in your piece caught my attention. You say the inspectors examine cars, quote, before each race and after each wreck, which, intentionally or not, makes it sound like wrecks are a virtual certainty. How busy are these inspectors?
Well, it depends on the track. Nextel Cup is actually up in your neck of the woods this weekend at New Hampshire International Speedway.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a short-ish track with tight corners, which means the cars will be sliding into each other. So at a track like that, they'll be pretty busy. In a couple of weeks after that, they'll be at Michigan International Speedway, which is like driving on a three-lane highway. I followed them around at a race there a couple of weeks ago, and there was only one incident that they needed to go check out.
It does seem that the inspectors are busier than normal wherever the cars happen to be racing in a given week. At Daytona alone, there were 5 crashes involving 20 cars. Is this just coincidence, a bad year, or are we seeing a trend?
I think it's a trend. There were a couple of changes that NASCAR made to the cars that made them harder to drive, and it sounds silly, but the tires are softer, which means they wear out faster, which makes it harder to drive, and the spoiler on the back is shorter than it used to be, so that decreases the downforce, so they slide around even more, and it's a little bit guys getting used to it and a little bit guys running out of talent.
Why would NASCAR want to make changes that make the cars harder to drive?
Because it also makes it more exciting. NASCAR would never say that out loud, but NASCAR fans are the ultimate gawkers. Any NASCAR fan who says he doesn't like crashes is full of it, frankly. I mean, they don't want guys getting hurt or anything like that, but it does require more skill of the drivers to handle these cars. And there were some concerns that if the tires don't wear out, it takes a lot of the strategy and a lot of the skill of the drivers and just makes it irrelevant.
Well, what are some of the improvements that have come out of this program? Because I gather there are some.
Yes, there are. CSI's major function is data collection. They examine a car after it's been in a wreck to see what that wreck did to the car. And the most interesting one, I think, is in seat mounts. It used to be conventional wisdom in racing circles that the seat should move on impact because that would lessen the chance of injury on the drivers. Well, the CSI team studied the data and found that there was a correlation between the seats moving and injuries. So what they did is they strengthened the seat mounts, like how the seats are connected to the car. They made that stronger so the seats don't move as much and the corresponding injuries have disappeared. That's the big one.
We've all heard stories of teams trying to bend the rules when it comes time for the technical inspections before the races. You know, shave something here, make something a little better here without breaking a rule. Do they do the same thing during safety inspections?
I don't think so. With the technical inspectors, the old saying is, if you ain't cheating, you ain't trying. And that's utterly true. You know, if a car is a quarter of an inch short, that's not an accident. It's not, oh, shucks, sorry, we didn't realize. They did that on purpose to try to gain an advantage. From the drivers and the crew chiefs and the owners and the talking to the safety inspectors, all of the safety information is based on hard data to make the car safer. These safety rules, they don't make the car slower. They make them safer. So the relationship is definitely much better.
And safer, as you're defining it, is more likely that a driver who gets in a crash will survive it and walk away, not less likely that he will crash.
Correct. That's a very good point. They're not really involved with... I guess there are measures of making the cars safer to drive, but that's really not their function. It's more what happens in a crash that a driver gets hurt. And one of the more interesting things I learned in interviewing these people is they take a lot of measurements of the car before a race. And the best example is like from the seatbelt or from the back of the seat to the steering wheel. And if that guy's in a crash, they take the same measurement again to see what moved. And if, let's say, the shoulder harness moves 6 inches, they call the doctor who's examining the driver and say, hey, check his shoulder for an injury. And it works in reverse, too, that if a driver's shoulder hurts, the doctor will tell them, hey, see if you can find a cause for this injury. And that's how they find a lot of things.
Although it isn't within the purview of your article, your particular study, I can't resist returning to the question, shouldn't NASCAR be looking for ways to cut down on accidents? Because accidents are going to hurt and kill people, all these safety inspections notwithstanding.
Oh, yeah, NASCAR is constantly working to make the race car safer. There's no doubt about that. I don't want to leave the impression that when they make the tire softer or the spoilers shorter, that they're throwing safety out the window. That's really a way of sort of leveling the competitive playing field. And I guess it's fair to call the cars more dangerous, but when you're racing at 180 miles an hour, those are small variations. I'm not sure that makes it that much more dangerous.
Matt Crossman writes about all things NASCAR for the Sporting News. Matt, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Well, thanks for having me on.
You might reasonably suppose that the job of a baseball player's agent would be to get his client the best possible deal with a major league ball club, but that's only the beginning of an agent's responsibilities. He also picks up his clients after they've wrecked their cars, argues with managers who want to bat their clients seventh instead of fourth, and loses sleep worrying that his clients will hire somebody else to do those jobs. Jerry Krasnick has written a book about the subject entitled License to Deal, A Season on the Run with a Maverick Baseball Agent. He joins me now from the studios of WHYY in Philadelphia. Jerry Krasnick, welcome to Only a Game.
Thanks for having me.
Of the baseball agent, you write, quote, his profession is a marriage of romance and sleaze, and he's either a detail man or an opportunist or both, depending on your vantage point. What vantage point did you assume when you first set out to write the book?
Well, I've always sort of been attracted, to these guys, that the agent business to me has sort of an allure to people. There's sort of an air of mystery, yet there is sort of a revulsion as well. You know, some people just think these guys are completely out for themselves. And what I really wanted to find out was how much truth it was. You know, do these guys really care about their players, or are they just in it for a buck?
You write a good deal about Matt Sosnick, the agent who represents Marlins pitcher Dontrell Willis. What led Matt to change careers and take up agenting?
Well, Matt was a guy who was sort of born into some affluence. His family had a warehouse where they sold groceries and cigarettes and that sort of thing. And he was the kind of kid as a youth who used to go there and get baseball cards and sit in his room and collect them. And then as a teenager, he started to morph into scalping concert tickets and selling baseball cards and that kind of thing. And I think he felt like he always had a sort of a flair for making deals. And, you know, he left college and decided to go into the family business for a while and did some sales. And he just felt like this was something that really, you know, he was meant for.
Dontrell Willis and a couple of Matt's other clients have had the logo of Matt's agency tattooed on their shoulders. There's a picture of this in the book. Given the way the business works, isn't that a little bit risky?
Yeah, it's a little bit extreme, and Dontrell's mother, among other people, thought it was a little bit much. That was really what sort of attracted me to this guy to begin with. I think when I called him to propose the possibility of doing this book, it was something he mentioned several minutes into our conversation was, you know what, a couple of my players have my company logo tattooed on their arm. And back then, Dontrell Willis was not a famous player. So that to me immediately just said, this guy's a character.
At one point in your discussions with Matt, he imagines that he would like to tell prospective clients the following. If you agree to let me represent you, I'll attack this job with my heart and soul, and I'll do the very best I can to be a good agent and help you in any way I can. No promises, he says, no sucking up to 19-year-olds who've been accustomed to star treatment most of their lives. Why can't Matt operate that way?
Well, I think because he probably feels like most other agents wouldn't. So this is a business, I think, in which you're largely defined by the actions of your competition. And will you sink to the level that they sink to, or will you try to rise above it? And I think that's what a lot of guys find who do this business is, you know, what kind of ethical and moral decisions do I have to make every day? And sometimes you really find yourself doing things that you don't particularly want to have to do.
At the other end of the spectrum from Matt are the gigantic agencies that are so successful at stealing clients from guys like him. How do they do it?
Well, I think a lot of times, I mean, there are situations where you get a guy an automobile or you slip him money in an envelope. Those are sort of the extreme cases. In a lot of cases, it's more working, say, your clients who are veteran clients on the same team who might be able to sort of exert a subtle pressure on your behalf. That's one way you can do it. And the other way, really, is to just appeal to the sense that these players have of, look, you have one shot to make a lot of money. Do you want to go with an agent like a Matt Sosnick who has no experience in salary arbitration and free agency, or do you want to go with my agency? And when you look at our track record, you know, player A, player B, player C, we've negotiated huge contracts for these guys. And a lot of these players think, well, I only have one shot. I have 2 or 3 years. And even though I'm friends with my current small agent, this bigger agent can do a lot more for me.
There is a certain sort of humor sometimes associated with the agenting business. Take us through the exchange that occurred during the baseball draft you monitored with Matt, the discussion about a player and former client named Mark Lowe.
Yeah, Mark Lowe was a pitcher at the University of Texas Arlington that Sosnick and Cobb were romancing and courting before the draft. They were competing against another agency led by Jeff Fry, who's a former Major League ball player. And Mark Lowe was a devout Christian ball player and trying to make a decision on which agency he would take. And I think in late March, a couple months before the draft, he informed Sosnick and Cobb's main recruiter that he was going to go with Jeff Fry. He said that the Lord had told him that that was the direction he should go in. So the draft comes, and Mark Lowe is sort of sinking down a little bit. He's not getting picked as high as he can. And during a lull in the conversation during the draft, Paul Cobb says, well, I guess the Lord told the scouting directors not to pick him as high as he had expected. So the Lord didn't really cut Mark Lowe a whole lot of slack in this case.
Julie Bradley, the mother of one of Matt Sosnick's clients, says at one point, quote, Matt was almost like an angel from heaven. What did Matt Sosnick have to do to merit that characterization?
Well, you have to keep in mind that for parents and kids, this is really a once-in-a-lifetime experience. You know, going through the draft and being romanced by scouts and wondering where you're going to be picked, hundreds of thousands of dollars are at stake in a lot of cases. And for Julie, it was a very stressful period. As a single mother, I think she said she lost 15 pounds during this thing, worrying about what was going to happen to her son. Should he go to college? Should he go into the draft? And Matt called her, and it was very comforting to her. He said, look, I'll take care of the scouts and the teams, and I'll do the intelligence and run the interference and really let you and your son concentrate on what you want to concentrate on. You can be a mother, he can be a ball player, and I'll handle the other stuff. And in this case, with him and a lot of these guys, the advisors can really take a major weight off the shoulders of the parents and the families and let them worry about really what they should be worrying about.
Since the book is primarily about Matt Sosnick, insofar as it is about one individual, tell us a little bit about what you think his future will be. Is he gonna stay with the agenting, or you know, will he eventually get his heart broken and have to find something else to do because so many players go with the big agencies instead?
Well, he's gotten his heart broken certainly numerous times. He's been at this for 8 years now, and only now is he really starting to get into the black, you know, as his agency starting to make money. He's at a really sort of critical time in the state of his agency. Dontrell Willis is about to break through as a star and get a big contract. They've also started to get a reputation, I think, you know, generally for the good as guys who work well with teams. And to be honest, I don't think this book is hurting them any. They're passing it out quite a bit to people. and they've done pretty well in the last draft that just came. They had 3 of the top 38 selections. So a lot of these minor league kids are starting to stay with them. And as they get to the cusp of the big leagues and do well, it really only takes a couple to establish yourself.
Jerry Krasnick is the author of License to Deal, subtitled A Season on the Run with a Maverick Baseball Agent. He spoke to me from WHYY in Philadelphia. The book is published by Rodale. Jerry, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you, Bill.
It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR in Boston. Additional support comes from Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Available at the Implant Dentistry Center at Bicon.com, BICON.com. And from the dairy farm families who own Cabot Creamery, five generations of farming and making naturally aged cheddar cheese in Vermont, on the web at CabotCheese.com.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, aspiring junior race walkers get their hips into it. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for a discussion of the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill.
The NHL will be back in October, but whether it will be better than ever is a very open question. Will the generally forgiving American sports public flock back to the league's frozen surfaces?
Well, remember, there was a story this week about the herd of sheep that went over a cliff in Turkey because the first sheep went and they all followed. That is what will bring the American hockey fan back to the National Hockey League next year. All, I guarantee you, will be forgiven if there's another half level that the players could, like, abase themselves. They'll find it. And they'll apologize for spending a year getting their brains beaten out in negotiations. I believe that the first chapter heading in the new collective bargaining agreement reads, "Thank you, sir. May I have another?"
Yes, exactly. Well, that was obviously that's the next question. It is customary after a strike or lockout to discuss what the players have won, what the owners have won. Is there anybody anywhere who thinks the players have won anything?
Near as I can tell, for 6 years, the NHL players will play for free.
There you go.
I mean, the salaries are rolled back. There's a salary cap. There's a minimum salary. There's what they call a salary floor, which is what they've been trying to ram down the baseball players' throats for years, but the baseball players have an actual union and not a clown car, so they haven't been successful. There's a window to buy out contracts. A still-determined percent of players' salaries will be placed in escrow, which I believe is a suburb of Edmonton, is it not?
With a bank.
Yes.
Jack Nicklaus failed to make the cut in this year's British Open, and so we've seen the last of one of golf's greatest, unless we haven't.
Well, he'll be around. I mean, this is the last major he's going to play for real, but I'm sure will be around. I know that it's a measure of his respect for the game, of course, that he finishes up at St. Andrews.
Meanwhile, Michelle Wee has failed in her quest to qualify for next year's Masters Tournament via this week's 80th U.S. Amateur Public Links Championship, the winner of which gets into the Masters. Did Hootie Johnson work his voodoo doll to crippling effect?
Actually, I think Michelle Wee just sort of got lost in the format and was never seen again. This is the most confusing golf tournament I've ever seen. It's match play. It's stroke play. It's a dessert topping. It's furniture polish.
It proves you can do it all.
But I think sooner or later they're going to have to come to grips with the fact that Michelle Wee is going to be the first woman to play in a men's major.
The American League won Major League Baseball's All-Star Game on Tuesday.
And boy,
night.
What a barrel of fun it
was.
Well,
absolutely. No news there. The American League always wins. But after the game, broadcasters Tim McCarver and Joe Buck were revealed as shills. News there, eh?
Well, I'm amazed they recovered from their conversion experience on the subject of Kenny Rogers. I thought Joe Buck was going to cry when he talked about the great courage Kenny showed for showing up at the All-Star Game after being suspended for assaulting a cameraman. No, there was a banner that read HHRYA.com, written in some sort of Gilbert and Sullivan Asian script. The two of them pretended like they didn't know what it meant. It turned out it was a website having to do with a Chevrolet promotion. They both knew perfectly well what it meant. But you've got Tim McCarver saying, "Well, I don't know what the sign means, but hooray is the first thing that comes to my mind." Well, hooray for you.
Yeah, who knew they could act so well? It's brilliant. Major League Baseball will apparently not agree to changes demanded by the International Olympic Committee, and so baseball will not be reinstated for the 2016 games. What objection does Major League Baseball have to the IOC's requirement?
The proximate cause of it, of course, is tougher anti-doping rules, but I think basically Major League Baseball has decided it can do without the Olympics. Its players don't particularly want to go. They have the World Cup of Baseball coming up, which I think is going to be a terrific promotion. And frankly, every time somebody tells the IOC to go climb a tree, I don't have a problem with that.
In what may or may not be a fit of pique, the mayor of Paris announced this week that his city will not bid for the 2016 Olympic Games. Why not?
It's a very big Monty Python segment this week. You remember that John Cleese has the knight on top of the battlements talking to the English?
Careful.
Yes,
here.
I know. I mean, I realize there's certain things about a general direction. Bertrand Delano, who's been running his mouth pretty strenuously over the last couple of weeks, is not going to bid for the 2016 Games. And will support a South American or African bid.
Ron Artest will be playing for the Pacers in the NBA's Summer League, and he will be an older, wiser Ron Artest, or so he says, albeit, in his words, quote, a ghetto-type older and wiser Ron Artest. What can we expect?
Yeah, I don't know what that last part means. I mean, I sort of know what it means, but I'm loath to comment on it because I don't know what Ron Artest means by it. Maybe this was enough. Maybe this was enough to show him that the guy is, you know, he was averaging 24 points a game when he got suspended
right.
last year. He was having a great season. You know, he's showing up in the summer league to play with the rookies. That demonstrates his commitment to play for the team, blah, blah, blah. Let's see what's going on in February.
Kobe Bryant's endorsement numbers are back up. Nike is featuring him again. Among organizations discouraged by that is the Colorado Coalition Against Sexual Assault. Have they got a point?
You know, they do have a point. There's no conviction here on the record. I mean, what are you going to do? I mean, the guys, yes, you can throw up the OJ precedent again. But the fact is that he was not tried. He was not convicted. He's back doing what he does for a living. As much as I appreciate the Colorado Coalition Against Sexual Assault's position, I don't know what they particularly want to do. I mean, unless they're saying that the accusation is enough.
Shifting gears, Mr. NASCAR, how do you feel about the institution at Lowe's Motor Speedway of a no-smoking, alcohol-free section of stands for the next Nextel Cup race there in October?
I think it's a great idea, but I guarantee you that at least 70% of the NASCAR fan base is screaming things about northern elitist wine-sipping yuppie
no
drones,
wine sipping even.
Drones taking over their sport. NASCAR has gone national. It's lost a little bit of its regional charm. This is part of it. This is a continuing attempt to make NASCAR popular in all parts of the country, which they've succeeded wildly at, I would point out. To have the Speedway in North Carolina, the center of the tobacco industry, to have a no-smoking section is quite an epical moment, I would say.
Andre Agassi announced this week that he has no plans to run for Congress in 2006. Isn't that what ambitious politicians always say right before they announce that they're running?
I think perhaps congressman is too small, but we have had in my lifetime Congressman Cooter, Congressman Gopher, and Congressman Sonny Bono. I'm very disappointed not to have the possibility to live through the Congressman Andre Agassi era.
Finally, Charlie, Jim Cripps of Nashville recently bowled a 279, which is a fine score for any bowler employing any method, any place, any time. He complained this week that the owners of some of the bowling alleys that he goes to believe that he's mocking the game. Why is that?
He bowls backwards.
Oh.
He turns his back to the pins, takes a step, and fires the ball backwards. And he rolled a 279. Now, I'm envisioning the moment where a guy, you know, he's in a sleeveless T-shirt and weighs about 400 pounds, is standing behind a counter spraying disinfectant into shoes and saying, "You're hurting the dignity of my game."
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine, and he helps me pull sports talk out of the gutter each week at this time. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
We don't play football because we can't drink our beer. We don't play hockey because we can't drink our beer. We don't play basketball, 'cause we still can't drink our beer. But there's one sport that we all love, 'cause we can drink our beers.
One, two, three, hey!
We're bowlers, we're members of a team. We're super-uper athletes, we're big and bad and mean.
You can share your comments with Only a Game by writing to us, care of WBUR-FM, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215, or by emailing oag@wbur.bu.edu. Please let us know on which station you hear Only a Game and how to pronounce your name. You can leave comments on our listener line by calling 617-353-1860. You can visit Only a Game's website at www.onlyagame.org.
Bowling and beer, hey! Bowling and beer,
right.
Fill up our mugs with fun and good cheer.
Hey!
Bowling and beer,
yeah!
Bowling and beer, God put us here for bowling and beer.
Hey!
Bowling and beer,
hey!
Bowling and beer,
yeah!
Fill up our mugs with fun and good cheer.
Yeah!
Bowling and beer, bowling and beer, God put us here for bowling and beer.
Walk, don't run was the mantra at the Junior Development Race Walk Camp held in Bar Harbor, Maine, which ran from July 3rd through 9th. The camp attracted some of the country's top young racewalking talent and culminated with the USA Junior National 5,000-meter Race Walk Championship. Only a Games' Michelle Seaton was there, and she has this report.
As 18-year-old Zach Pollinger strides down the track, all eyes are on his hips.
Just 3 days ago, 4 days ago, it was just a continuous motion.
Go up and down a little bit.
Come on back.
Hips forward, not up and down.
That's the rotation, which gains him a longer, effective stride length.
Pollinger is a two-time junior national racewalking champion who can walk a mile in just over 6 minutes. But coaches at this week-long camp in Bar Harbor, Maine, have spent days refining his stride. They've nagged him to twist his hips with each step while turning his shoulders in the opposite direction. This will give him the maximum stride length with the minimum effort. Pollinger, who will compete in the Junior Pan American Games in Windsor, Ontario, at the end of July, will have to work quickly to incorporate this training.
I have a lot of work to do on my technique, actually, and Tom Easler has always had a big problem with my technique, which is that I don't use my hips enough, so that's definitely been my main focus for this camp.
Coach Tom Easler, one of the organizers of this camp, explains that twisting the hips might add 3 inches to a walker's stride. In a 5K race, those inches add up.
Bottom line is two people walking together with the same cadence, the same stride length, because what happens, you increase the length by 3 inches by doing this as opposed by not doing that. But the turnover rate is the same. Let's say 200 steps a minute. By the end of the race, one of them will be over 1,200 feet in front of the other.
This hip-twisting motion is different from the waddling duck walk taught by the older generation of coaches. Coach Gary Westerfield says that all international champions twist their hips to lengthen their strides.
We have seen, in looking at American walkers on the national level, the top walkers don't use their hips very much. We go into international competition, and you look at some of the other athletes, the best athletes, and their hips are rotating.
This philosophy is the latest thinking in international racewalking circles, yet it is completely new to most of the 20 campers here, including 14-year-old Christopher Stewart.
The hip rotation, I never even knew you were supposed to have that. So I just knew your hips were supposed to move. Like, I thought it was up and down, but instead it's like forward and back. But it doesn't go back, it just goes forward.
Getting the chance to improve his technique is nice, but the real reason Stewart has traveled to Maine from New Jersey to attend this camp is to spend time with elite racewalkers, or any racewalkers. Stewart is the only walker at his school, and he has just one training partner, his mom.
When I train, it's mainly myself and my mom, and when she comes with me, I slow down, because she slows me down, so she has to jog to keep up.
National junior champion Zach Pollinger agrees.
A lot of us train by ourselves every single day of the year. I know that I do, and it gets a little bit disheartening when you have to go out on the same course every single day by yourself to do a hard workout, and come into a place like this and being around a lot of people who share the same experiences and, you know, problems with training and things like that. It's just really, really great motivation. It's great to meet other people like this and see a lot of people that you race and compete with.
The reason why so many elite racewalkers train alone is because there are only 2 states in the country, Maine and New York, that offer racewalking in their high school athletic teams. As a result, most of the top racewalkers in the country come from these 2 states. Coach Tom Easler is proud of the fact that Maine's program has been so dominant.
Maine kids alone in the last 10 years have earned 119 All-American Awards. Their high school All-American Track and Field Athlete Awards. 119 of them, 37 kids from 22 schools. We only have about 150 high schools in Maine, so do the math. 22 out of 150 is a decent percentage of the high schools in the state of Maine have at least one All-American Award that was brought to them by high school racewalkers. It's been a very successful program.
Easler has organized this camp to help train and inspire the top young racewalkers in the country. The last time a camp like this was held in Maine was a decade ago. Easler says it was a phenomenal success.
The camp we did 10 years ago developed 2 Olympians and 6 or 7 national team members. And this camp, I believe 10 years from now, we will see 2 or 3 Olympians having been at this camp. Doesn't mean we made them that way, but we've been assisting them. It's a long road to hoe.
In the racewalking community, the word is out about this camp, which is the only one of its kind. 15-year-old Ricardo Vergara and his brother Roberto pooled their birthday money to pay their way to Bar Harbor. They traveled from their home in Edinburgh, Texas, which is near the Mexican border.
We have a coach. He teaches us every day. If we want to practice in the morning, at 4 o'clock in the morning, he'll show up so he can practice with us.
You have to practice at 4 o'clock in the morning?
That was in the beginning of school. We were practicing for the Canada versus the USA, and we had school, and then after school we had band and or swimming or something, so we had to practice in the mornings.
The culmination of this junior development race walk camp is a 5,000-meter race that, in theory, should give walkers a chance to practice the new techniques they've learned in camp. Hurricane Cindy has brought cold winds and driving rain to Bar Harbor on race day.
We would appreciate a volunteer to come out and help us hold the tent down. It seems to be taking off. So if somebody could come on over, I see someone headed this way now with their umbrella, please. Thank you.
Walkers, on your marks.
It's no surprise to anyone that national champion Zach Pollinger laps the entire field during the 5K race to finish with a time of 22 minutes and 12 seconds. The race's big surprise was 13-year-old Matthew Forges of Bar Harbor, Maine, who stunned his competitors, his parents, and himself by finishing at 27 minutes 45 seconds, despite the fact that he's too young to be competing at this level. Forges credits the camp for his surge in speed.
I feel faster, and just being around all these like positive race walkers, knowing that they do the same thing as I do, and you can just learn stuff from watching them. And then we've done a lot of technique work, so that really helps.
Forge's long-term goals just got more ambitious.
Long-term goal is definitely the Olympics, but for now, just because my sister got to go to Lima, Peru, all paid for because she qualified for the Pan Am Cup, so that's some of my goals.
For Only a Game, I'm Michelle Seaton in Bar Harbor, Maine.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is John Perotti. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To order a copy of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287, toll free. CDs and cassettes are $15. That's 1-800-909-9287. If you'd like to learn more about License to Deal, browse Only a Game show archive, or sign up for our newsletter, please visit onlyagame.org. Our final word comes from London Times golf writer Matthew Side, who details his breakfast at St. Andrews.
Double sausage, bacon, toast, beans, mushrooms, a cup of tea.
What? No side of beef, block of cheddar, magnum of heavy cream? Not a bit of best bitter? Has the British Open suddenly gone heart healthy? I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced, from NPR member stations, from the W.K. Kellogg Foundation, from vision to innovative impact, 75 years of philanthropy, on the web at wkkf.org, and from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation. This is NPR, National Public Radio.